This is MR Radio, I'm GW, and as usual I have Daniel with me online, and today we're very pleased to have as our guest a man who describes himself as a modern day adventurer, as having led a Marco Polo life. He's travelled very widely to virtually every country on the planet. He is also the author of the book America on the Brink, which you may have heard of. He is Frosty Wooldridge. Hello Frosty, welcome to MR Radio.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I hope during our time together, every single person listening to this broadcast gains a greater understanding of humanity's predicament here in the 21st century, the dilemma that all of us face as human beings, not only the human species, but also all other creatures on the planet. And of course, I'm talking about the aspect of human population, of environmental degradation, and certainly all of the aspects that entails, because everyone around the world really will be affected by the things that we talk about. And so I'm very excited to do this with you.
And we're very excited to have you here. Frosty, can you tell us something about your personal background, where you're from, some of what ultimately informs your activism?
Well, thank you. I certainly can, Daniel. I am a Michigan farm boy by origin, and I grew up with a father who was a military man from Michigan, and he was transferred with the family to different bases around the United States and out of the United States all of my 18 years. So I really got a taste for travel very early as a child, and always loved it. My father introduced me to athletics, certainly travel, mountain climbing, rafting rivers, scuba diving, and everything you could imagine. And so that childhood was really rich with new experiences, meeting new people and going to different countries. From that point, I then graduated from high school and became a Michigan State University student. And of course, through the tremulous 60s, from 1965 through 70, I was an undergraduate, graduated from Michigan State University in journalism, then on to English literature, postgraduate degree from Grand Valley State University. And from that point, became a teacher, a math and science teacher out in Denver, Colorado. And of course, I had summers off, but very little money. And what I had promised myself after graduating from college was to bicycle all seven continents. And so, in the last 40 plus years of my life, I have bicycled from the Arctic all the way to Antarctica. And during those journeys, I learned a great deal. I inculcated cultures and languages and people and terrain and all sorts of exciting moments, if you will.
So that led up to your take on the cause of population and destruction of common earthly resource. It would be interesting to hear something about your travels. They sound fascinating. How many countries have you been to? Can you highlight some of the interesting, the bizarre?
Yes, I can. Almost, I've had some pretty wild and bizarre moments. I certainly could have died along the way, probably at least a half dozen times. I've been caught up in earthquakes, bushfires, certainly hurricanes and typhoons. I've been caught up in unbelievable moments in the rainforests of South America. And of course, I've been in category one conditions with 150 mile an hour katabatic winds down in Antarctica. I've camped and bicycled in Antarctica. I've bicycled and walked on the wall of China. I've stood on the Arctic Ocean. I've scuba dived in all of the oceans of the world. Probably what happened to me as a young kid was in 1984 when I started in Hong Kong. And then traveled, push-biked, and so forth, all the way to the Wall of China, the Ming Dynasty, and then through Asia and Bangladesh. That's when I came into the understanding that the human race was on a collision course with its own numbers, and I saw it quite graphically with the poverty and the crowding and the compaction of humans there in China, the Yangtze River, which I sailed, was an open sewer pipe leading into the ocean and creating a 20,000 square mile dead zone. Of course, the Ganges, the same thing, and the poverty in India and certainly in Bangladesh was intractable. And that changed my whole worldview. And since that time, I've written a dozen books, and I've written thousands of articles and done many commentaries and spoken on over 1,500 radio shows. I've been on the major network TVs, networks like CNN and Fox and ABC, NBC, CBS, to try to bring into context what the human race faces here in the 21st century. So that's a little bit of what happened to me as I was traveling around the world.
For all these facts, the clear and present danger of population, its looming destruction, our quality of life, and even the possibility for a future for our children, there has been this executive amnesty of Mexicans in America. In England, we've had the confessions of the Labour Party, Muslims being dumped into France, African boat refugees making their way into Europe by way of Lampedusa. You are attempting to get across these hazards and the as clear and factual implications, which should be alarming to us all, and yet you have been met with obstruction time and again in trying to make these facts known to the public and acted upon by responsible institutional bodies. Do you have any theories or even direct examples as to who or what is obstructing your activism?
Well, absolutely, yes. One of the things that we're facing here in the 21st century is different worldviews. And if you look at the corporations in America or certainly in Europe, there is always the desire to expand markets. And capitalism itself is an endless consumption machine. And so those with the worldview that there is no end to the amount of expansion, and then which means more growth and more production, and then, of course, more consumption. When you have that kind of a paradigm, you don't see the other side of it. And, of course, as a scuba diver, I've watched the oceans become plasticized. As a world traveler being stuck in, again, there's 100-mile gridlock traffic in places like China, and you even have that in São Paulo in South America. And then when you start looking at what's happening to the countries around the world, please realize, and I did the study on this, that there are between 78 and 86 million added human beings, babies, added to the planet every year now, net gain. And they're coming from probably around 140 countries around the world that are failing as far as the economic systems. They're failing as far as birth control to at least give their numbers a balance to the carrying capacity of their countries. In other words, the water supply, the food supply, the arable land. And then you also have these countries that have cultures that simply do not benefit literacy. And so what has happened, and I think it was Jean Raspail wrote the Camp of the Saints out of France about 35 years ago, and I have a copy of it. And he talked about the fact that these countries such as India or China or Bangladesh or Mexico or even South America, Brazil, Indochina, which I've seen up close and personal, they simply cannot sustain the numbers. And again, 80 million new babies net gain every year, a billion every 12 years. And when I was in college, the human race was around 3 billion. Now it's 7.2 billion, headed for 10.1 billion by 2050, which is a scant 36 years from now. And what I have found is that those in power, whether it's the Prime Minister of the UK, Cameron, or it's even Angela Merkel of Germany, or any of the leaders, they refuse to talk about the crisis of population and its impact on the carrying capacity of the planet, certainly of its the exhaust of carbon, the consumption of goods, and metals and materials, which are exhausting themselves. And of course, the great driver of all this is gasoline. And that, of course, at some point will exhaust itself. leaving nothing but these huge populations to feed without enough water and certainly without enough arable land to do that.
So they have their motives and what they're doing, and they're keeping the populations unaware of impending doom by cognitive dissonance, you say.
Well, that's correct. And let me give you, when you talk about what Barack Obama did to the United States here with his latest executive amnesty, you have to understand that Mexico, which has over 15 million illegal migrants here in the United States, disrupting the school systems. As a matter of fact, here in Denver, the United States is taking in 100,000 legal immigrants every 30 days, and that comes out to 1.2 million per year. And when you take that number out 36 years from now with their births and the chain migration, America is about to import 100 million more immigrants legally into this country. And what it's doing is, and I'm going to quote this from the former James Walsh, the former general counsel of the United States Immigration and Naturalization Service, and this applies to Europe, it applies to Australia, and it applies to Canada, and of course America, because these are the places where these desperate immigrants are flooding into, because there are no other places in the world that will take them or that can sustain them. And here is the quote. Immigrants devoted to their own cultures and religions are not influenced by the secular, politically correct facade that dominates academia, news media, entertainment, education, religious, and political thinking today, Walsh said. These immigrants claim the right not to assimilate, and the day is coming when the question will be, how can the United States regulate the defiantly unassimilated cultures, religions, and mores of foreign lands? Such immigrants say their traditions trump the U.S. legal system. Balkanization of the United States has begun, unquote.
So that's interesting. Go on.
I could say that that same quote by James Walsh could be applied to Europe. Mm-hmm. It could certainly be applied to the United Kingdom. It could be applied to Australia right now, and it certainly applies to places like Canada and America, where we now, like in Denver, Colorado, we have 172 different languages. And Immanuel Kant, the great philosopher, said that the two great dividers are religion and language. So if you take a country, or you take the UK, or you take Europe, and you inject all of these different ethos and these worldviews, and let me have you appreciate the listener right now. If you take 140 different countries that are failing their citizens, and they flee those countries because of overpopulation or fighting for resources, and then inject them into Spain or France or Italy or Germany or Austria or into Holland or into Belgium, which right now is facing a complete Islamic takeover and becoming an Islamic state, or even Sweden or Norway, you're injecting 140 different worldviews from third world countries that have no reasonable affinity to the worldview of Western thought.
So you're saying that political correctness has something to do with this cognitive dissonance?
That's exactly correct, because political correctness stomps out, crushes, and eradicates critical thinking and rational reasoning and logical understanding of a predicament or an equation. And what happens is that Western humanity, which has created this thing called political correctness, is actually creating its own form of suicide, because you don't see all of these third world immigrants flooding into China. They're not flooding into Japan. They're not flooding into India. And you
Is it suicide? It has something to do with the 1965 Immigration Act, which you cite.
Well, as a matter of fact, Seymour Lipset, the great historian, said that nations don't die; they actually create they create their own suicides. And if you look back through the ash heap of humanity, and certainly the histories of great civilizations, the Romans killed themselves by allowing the Visigoths and the Vandals and the Goths to come down and literally bring their languages, bring their customs, and bring their young men who then went into the Roman armies. But when the Romans tried to fight, the Visigoths, the Goths, and the Vandals simply broke ranks and ran or sided with the enemies.
I see it as a bit more nuanced than that. We have a susceptibility due to our enlightenment and Christian universalism and individualism, mm-hmm. which has been taken advantage of.
I'd go even further than that. I mean, I think if you look at the reasons for these population expansions, fundamentally the root of that is in European man. It's in our relation to nature. It's in the fact that in a cold climate environment, the only way for a people to survive and to continue to transmit its genes onto the future is to master nature and not be nature's creature. And I think that that has always characterized our way of being. It's the source of our creativity and intelligence and the source of our civilization. And I think that we've managed to export this type of approach, if you like, to most places in the world now, and one of the results of that is that we're seeing longevity in populations where it didn't exist before, and we're seeing survivals where it did not exist before, and the whole thing is getting away. Because we're a very compassionate peoples, we respond when emergencies do arise with them, and we rush to minister to them and try to keep them alive and so forth. So, you know, in a way, the whole thing has got some root into the sort of Promethean mindset of European man. And, you know, then you take the other aspects, which you've referred to, political correctness. I think it's quite a sort of long way downstream, but you know, certainly the liberal mentality, which is post-Christian way of thinking in the West, that too has driven our attitudes, and you can feed into that also the fact that we're quite an individualistic and highly altruistic people, but we combine these two qualities in a way that sort of leaves our own interests out and tends to have us empathize with the other. So there are a number of quite subtle factors engaged in this whole problem which coalesce to make it difficult for us to actually act in our own interests when we should, because it's cruel and selfish, and encourage us to act in the interests of others. So, you know, that's the fundamentals as far as I would see it. The political correctness thing, yes, okay. When you're looking at the way that the official mindset works, the institutional mind, certainly that's the case, but then where has political correctness actually come from? It's come from another source entirely, which I think Daniel is probably better to equipped to speak about than I am. But anyway, I'm not sure that people who are engaged in looking at the population crisis and looking at it from an environmental point of view really have ever wanted, perhaps because of political correctness, to look at the underlying factors, you know, that I've been speaking about. And at this late stage, perhaps there's not a tremendous payoff in doing so, unless you take pleasure in really getting to the bottom of why things are as they are.
Well, GW, if I could add to that, one of the things that we're not dealing with in Canada or Australia or Europe or the UK or America is the sociological aspect of the PC. And here's just a quote from Jean Raspail from the Camp of the Saints, and he said, and I quote, as this massive armada was descending on Europe from India because it was starving and it was desperate and so forth, the captain of one of the ships was talking to one of the more intelligent of this massive of armada of desperate people, and the old man said, you don't know my people, the squalor, superstitions, the fatalistic sloth that they've wallowed in for generations. You don't know what you're in for if that fleet of brutes ever lands in your lap. Everything will change in this country of yours. They will swallow you up. Unquote. If you look at the sociological aspects of mass immigration, you will see that the differing tribes, whether it's the African tribe, whether it's the Middle Eastern tribe, whether it's the Hindu tribe, whether it's the Indian tribe, whether it's the Latino tribe of Mexico that's now importing itself into the United States, or the Muslim tribe, of course, that's coming out of the Middle East, that has a totally different sociological viewpoint. And in fact, the world view of Muslims, that Muslims have a world view that women are totally subjugated to the man's domination. There's no First Amendment rights of freedom of speech. There's no women's rights. There's no right of dress. There's no right of choice of religion. There are such things as honor killings. There are such things as arranged marriages of 12-year-old girls to 40-year-old men. That's the norm. There's such things as terrifying. In fact, there are 5,000 murders committed every year in the Muslim-dominated countries of their women for women making a mistake by dishonoring the husband or the brother. And you're now seeing that kind of injection into beheadings here in America. We have beheadings in the last 10 years. We have behandings in America. There are beheadings in the streets of London right now. The female genital mutilation, which is one of the barbaric acts of those people, is now becoming a norm here in the United States and certainly in Canada. And I'm sure it's also becoming a norm in Australia. So what most Westerners and certainly Europeans and the European folks, Caucasians, having generated more parliamentary law, more critical thought, more enlightenment, as they inject more and more of these people from these lands, certainly North Africa is flooding into, and Central Africa flooding into Europe right now, again, because they simply can't feed themselves, they're living under terror and so forth. But because their worldview is exactly like what has happened to them in their cultures, they are then bringing and impregnating first world countries like France and like Holland and like Belgium and like Spain and Germany and Italy and so forth, Austria. They're impregnating these 6th century barbaric cultures and religions into these new countries where they inhabit. And now
what do you think about Bill Gates and Warren Buffett's approach to? Do you think that they're just exacerbating the population problems?
That's exactly correct. One of the things I've discovered as an educator and as a critical thinker is that the reason for all these failed countries is, number one, illiteracy. Illiteracy defines a failed culture, because when you think about it, how can these countries that are pumping out, and I'll give you a background on this, there are 57 million deaths every year around the world for every kind of reason. Well, the third world, because it has 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 and 7 and 8 children, not only completely replaces the 57 million people who die every year out of 7.2 billion, it also adds another 80 million. So you have 137 million new babies on the planet every 365 days. Ask yourself, how do you educate, how do you medicate, how do you sustain, how do you feed, how do you water, and literally sustain those children? And the answer is you can't, and you don't, and they aren't. And so then you have all of this illiteracy permeating these civilizations, and what happens with all of this illiteracy is it repropagates itself to add another, 137 million more babies the following year, and the cycle continues. So the poverty and the cultural illiteracy and the cultural poverty literally magnifies and expands. And as I said, we're on course for another 3 billion human beings on the planet. So
you say that it's mostly a matter of cognitive dissonance that Europeans aren't aware of this.
That's right.
Wouldn't you say that their fear of being called racists has something to do with it as well?
Mother Nature doesn't care if you're brown, you're red, you're black, you're yellow, you're white, or whatever. Mother Nature kills with no sense of race or color or creed or otherwise. And so this is not about racism. It's about sustainability.
But Europeans are often afraid to say things in critical of population explosion because they're going to be called racists.
Well, and that's the tragedy, because Mother Nature doesn't care. And so if we continue in that same vein where we fear to deal with reality, we continue in cognitive dissonance. And as a matter of fact, the great Dr. Albert Bartlett, whom I work with for years, decades, he talked about it as enumeracy. And so people who were mathematically challenged, in other words, people who were illiterate of mathematical reality and equations, are enumerates. In other words, they're illiterate. As a matter of fact, I'll use another quote here that I think is quite brilliant. It was by the Nobel laureate, Dr. Henry Kendall. He said, and I quote, "If we don't halt population growth with justice and compassion, it will be done for us by nature, brutally and without pity, and will leave a ravaged world," unquote. So you can play the game of political correctness and cognitive dissonance or enumeracy for as long as you want, because at this point you may have enough water, you may have enough gasoline, and you may not have enough arable land. But as China is finding out right now, and certainly India, which I've traveled through extensively, they don't have any arable land, and they're going into South America, and they're going into Africa trying to buy up land. And as a matter of fact, the Chinese are now heading into British Columbia, Canada, and overwhelming that state. But the Muslims are also overwhelming Europe right now. Yeah. And so no matter what you do, somebody's going to pay the piper at some point. And some of these the great thinkers, and here's another quote I think each listener would appreciate. It's by the great Dr. E.O. Wilson, who's a Harvard scholar and biologist, and he said, and I'm quoting, "The raging monster upon the land is population growth. In its presence, sustainability is but a fragile theoretical construct. To say, as many do, that the difficulties of nations are not due to people, but to poor ideology and land use management is sophistic," unquote. Mm-hmm. So the key here is to bring the conversation to reality rather than to political correctness, because political correctness does not deal with reality, and then we become victims of not dealing with reality.
Well, the reality, it seems, is that Europeans are the ones who are on the chopping block, because
that's right.
What I looked at, that per capita birth rate, Africa had sub-Saharan Africa had 44 of the first 51 countries in per capita birth rate.
And well, as a matter of fact, Africa right now, with 1 billion people, is on course to triple to 3 billion people before the end of this century. You can look that up on the UN population projections. So Africa, with 1 billion people today, that's already starving, and people are fleeing the Congo and the Sudan and the Kenya and Ethiopia to come to America and Canada and so forth, and flooding into Europe. Can you imagine when they add another 2 billion people, that those people would be very hungry and very thirsty, and just about every creature that flies or crawls upon the land there in Africa is going to be used for soup and dinner.
But it's not just numbers. It's also the qualities of Africans and the qualities of Europeans, because Europeans are probably best suited to get a grip on these ecological and human ecological problems, and Africans, on the other hand, are such a strong people. They've evolved over a much longer period of time than Europeans, maybe 250,000 years. So they're going to be less sensitive, perhaps, to more impervious to environmental effects in the short term, and maybe able to endure the initial phases of environmental destruction.
There's no question on that, Daniel. If you look at the African tribes, are much more and closer to the earth therefore able to feed themselves to some degree, but they too will collapse as their numbers grow. But when you start talking about these highly technological societies, I can guarantee this, that once gasoline is not there and the alternative energies can't fulfill what gasoline does today, then the bread on the shelves and the transportation and the ability to feed ourselves and water ourselves as first world technologically run societies on the energy slave, of course, oil, then you're going to see much quicker breakdown and much quicker desperation on a larger level.
If we can get a hold of these population problems, there are people who are working on solutions to feeding a population once managed. MR's James Bowery, he's involved with some of those projects.
Blue tuna farming, or this sort of thing.
Right.
Now, I was just going to say that, the African sociobiology, Frosty, is quite well equipped to overcome disease and drought. You know, when you're talking about how people come into the possession of their own characteristics, as it were, it's evolutionary, and African sexualization is the solution to the problem of the African environment. When you travel north, large numbers are of no use to you in a cold climate because you can't feed them. So you have to have a different evolutionary strategy, and that is intelligence and cephalization.
And actually, Europe and the Caucasian race is really degrading their numbers in context, and certainly with the viability of sustainability. So they've done the intelligent thing, but you see, the rest of the world hasn't. In fact, Bangladesh right now is a country that most Europeans don't have a size appreciation, but Iowa. Iowa is a state in America that's not that, it's not a big state. It's not like Texas, but Iowa is a state that's about 350 miles long and about 250 miles wide. And Bangladesh has 157 million people in a landmass less than the size of Iowa. And in fact, with 157 million before the mid-century, they're expected to add another 30 or 40 million. And so what you're going to see again is all of these desperate people, as Jean Raspail talked about in his book, Camp of the Saints, flooding into Europe, flooding into Canada, flooding into America. And at some point, there won't be ability to water or feed these people. And we're quickly approaching that. In fact, we are already there. We're living beyond the carrying capacity. That was proven, in fact, by Dr. Albert Bartlett. Now I'm going to quote him. He said, and I quote, "Unlimited population growth cannot be sustained. You cannot sustain growth in the rates of consumption of resources. No species can overrun the carrying capacity of a finite landmass. This law cannot be repealed, and it is not negotiable," unquote, Dr. Albert Bartlett. If you understand that, then you understand the dilemma that we face. And it is a humanity dilemma, because no one gets out of off the planet for free on this deal. And in order to create viable civilizations in the 21st century, we have to come to terms with stabilized populations, in fact declining populations, that live within the carrying capacity of a landmass that they are sitting on at this point.
And you're talking of a concern that should be everyone's, and yet you've been met with obstruction by what's been the mainstream media.
That's correct.
You mentioned 60 Minutes.
That's correct. 60 Minutes, Charlie Rose, ABC, NBC, CBS.
But Charlie Rose is supposed to be so
NPR.
NPR is supposed to be so liberal. Charlie Rose is supposed to be so
right. They're supposed to be intelligent. They're supposed to be Robert Siegel of NPR, Terry Gross, Leanne Hansen. They are literally avoiding any discussion or anyone who discusses. I'm not the only one. There are fantastic. There's David Paxson of worldpopulationbalance.org, and for those of you who want to go there, worldpopulationbalance.org. You've got Roy Beck of numbersusa.org, brilliant. He has the two videos, a five-minute video on immigration, poverty, and gumballs, which every
citizen... You've got them up at MR.
Yep. There you go. And then, of course, he has a 10-minute video called Immigration Off the Charts, which shows the final equation of overpopulation here in the United States, but it can be applied to all over the world. You can go to CAPS Web, CAPSWEB.org, with Joanne Weidman. She is absolutely brilliant. You've got Jenny Goldie over there in Australia. You've got Madeline Weld in Canada. So there are speakers out there. There's Kurt Dahl, who he is absolutely brilliant. And you can go on down the line. Don Collins in Washington, D.C., who has been a writer on this population issue. So,
but NPR and Charlie Rose and 60 Minutes won't hear of it.
That's exactly right. Again, because their worldview is the prevailing worldview, like the Pope's worldview when he crushed Galileo. But no matter what,
this is a quasi-religion. This PC,
pretty much, it's a quasi-religion.
Is it really PC? Quite a lot of the people you mentioned are Jewish, and Jews. There's a wonderful article actually written by the Catholicized Jew Larry Oster. He died a couple of years ago. It was written in 2004, and it's on David Horowitz's Front Page magazine, which is a sort of in which he explains in a slightly sanitized way. I mean, it's not a raw, honest piece of work, but he explains in the title of the piece is Why Jews Welcome Muslims, because ordinarily you would think that they wouldn't want to do that. They're sort of existentially conflicted with Islam, and you wouldn't expect them to support the growth of Muslim populations in the Jewish or close to the Jewish diaspora populations, but they do. And he says that for a Jew, crazy as it sounds, the ultimate enemy is Christian Europe, and he is blind to any other threats. That's the way they think, and that's straight out of the horse's mouth. But I wouldn't trust Jewish sources personally on any matter to do with the freedom and survival of Europeans. That's not where I'd look for an authoritative response. The other thing is that if you're talking to the mainstream media, they're entirely dependent on the big corporations. They don't exist without them, and they can't start producing material that the big corporations would find anathema.
Have the corporations and Jewish interests left an out for themselves, or are they just blind to the fact that they're killing themselves as well?
Well, I'm sure that in the case of Jews who are socio-biologized in the form that Kevin MacDonald has it in Culture of Critique and his other works, I'm sure that they are blind, and they're totally and completely dedicated to the sort of, you know, pursuit of Olam Haba and the age of Moshek, and you know, that's true of secular and religious Jewry. I think that that's the case, and it's a tragedy. It's a tragedy for Jews and for non-Jews that is the case.
Well, that's exactly correct. You know, as a matter of fact, the eminent satirist was Mark Twain in America 100 years ago. And he talked about a similar aspect of what we're talking about, and he called it the silent assertion lie. And at the time he talked about it, the slavery was the question. And I'll just quote from his point. The universal conspiracy of the silent assertion lie is hard at work always and everywhere, and always in the interest of the stupidity or sham, never in the interest of a fine thing or a respectable thing. It is the most timid and shabbiest of all lies, the silent assertion that nothing is going on which fair and intelligent men and women are aware of and are engaged by their duty to try to stop it. And unquote. And so what you're seeing here with political correctness, which is also the same thing as the silent assertion lie, is that let's shed the reality. Let's go into an intellectual dance that we can pretend that reality's not going to touch us, but in fact, no matter who you are, whether you are Catholic or Jewish or black or white or brown, every person in technological societies will be affected, because at some point, even in the UK right now, the UK, as I understand, has around 59 million British people living in the UK.
I don't think
and the
British,
UK is the sick. Well, not all British
it's about,
anymore.
It's, I think it's between 62 and 63 million.
62, okay, it's 62 million. But you're also, because of immigration into the UK, on course to add another 11 million. And what's amazing to me is that the United Kingdom has a landmass less than the size of the state of Oregon, which I just bicycled through this summer. And there's only 3 million people in Oregon, and they think it's too crowded right now. And the fact is that the UK couldn't possibly operate or feed itself if it wasn't for oil, and it can't possibly maintain its ethos. It cannot maintain its own parliamentary democratic process, because it's importing all of these different worldviews from the Islamic lands. And now you're seeing the separation of what, even London right now, because I think there's something around 2.5 million Islamic followers there in the United Kingdom.
Correct.
And so you're creating two different countries or two different ethos. And as the numbers grow from, let's say, another 11 million you allow into the country, then the United Kingdom can't possibly survive the breakdown of ethos, and certainly the breakdown of parliamentary law. Because one of the things that I've found, and my brother Howard speaks Arabic and lived in an Arabic-speaking land for a year until he just fled it because he said it was too crazy, and that is that the Islamic approach is never to give up and to be aggressive toward, again, as I said, in the Quran, which I studied, is to convert or kill all non-believers, especially the Jews. And so,
GW, what extent do you think we're being encouraged by Jewish interests to fight their war against Muslims by proxy?
Yeah, I think that's I wouldn't say it's a war by proxy. I would say that it's a condition, an existential condition of conflict, long-term, without a solution, that is being established. It's not a war for victory. Nobody must win this victory. The point is that in the globality, you need conflict.
It's got to keep paying dividends.
Liberalism and socialism had a conflict in society that was class-based. And then in 1923, we had this Institution for Social Research, I think, which authored a new form of conflict, which came to us as anti-white hegemonic politics. So suddenly we've got identity politics of all kinds.
Sexism, homophobia.
Little gifts of modernity to struggle with. So conflict remains very much in that form today. And I mean, I know, because I go onto a number of newspaper threads and have discussions with people, and you know, the word racist or homophobe or you know, whatever,
sexist,
gets thrown every 2 seconds at some poor devil somewhere. It's endemic.
Yes, it does.
So, you know, again, this conflict has been created. So you have to ask yourself, where does it all come from, and why is conflict so central? It's not coming out of our own society. It's coming into us from politics. It's coming into us from philosophy.
Well, we do have a valuation of conflict in Western society, on the other hand, which disgusts me. Darwinism, this is a mechanism, of course, but competition occurs on a certain level, and our cooperation is so underplayed in the stories that people tell about their life. If you go out in the everyday, almost everything is cooperation. It's not competition.
This is true. I mean, you know, they talk about capitalism as being a competitive system, but it's a cooperative system. You know, the competition is there in terms of price and market, but actually the whole thing is dependent on cooperation, on contract and trust. So that there's a lot more to it than pure conflict. But in our politics, we are only really given a conflict model. And this has been the case really probably since the working class self-help movement in the 19th century, mid-19th century, began to take on more and more of the sort of Marxistic analysis. And certainly by the time you got the Fabians, who came in after the First World War, then there's a clear ideology of conflict being imposed, working class against the, you know, capitalist classes against them, so on and so forth. If you look at the Russian Revolution, the enemy was the bourgeois middle class, and so on and so forth. So, you know, you will always have this conflict being driven in from political sources, where in actual fact it may not exist. And if that stopped, then you are more likely to find that a homogeneous society will develop comity, mutual respect, and cooperative forms. They should just emerge out of the kinship that exists. That should be an automatic process.
I think that part of that is our fault. It's our love of objectivism as Europeans. It's been capitalized on by our enemies, but I think that part of it is our fault.
But in any case, you know, the arrival of Muslims and the, you know, multiculturalism in general as a model filled with different communities, any number you like, each true unto themselves, each pursuing their own interests, and every one of them together existentially conflicted with the native European people, wherever it is. You know, that model is a fact. It has been placed there quite independently, really, of the flood that's arriving. And Frosty is talking about a phenomenon, almost a natural phenomenon. There is this analysis that it's a kind of force of nature, that there's this huge push to the civilized north because that is where light and warmth and food and protection exists, welfare, you know, everything. It's all there, and so they all come in with hope in their hearts. It's presented like that, but at the same time the borders have actually been opened by the hands of politicians, and the dicta of anti-racism and political correctness and of neo-Marxist, you know, egalitarianism, radical egalitarianism and so on, all of this has been dictated by politicians. So there is this superstructure of enabling that takes place, and of course that's what's really killing us, because it takes away our capacity as peoples to defend ourselves. That's also a deliberate and very political part of this equation, which you know, perhaps is not quite so much in Frosty's domain, but is certainly now.
Oh yes, it is. You're finding here in America right now, and I bring this to a very clear understanding. There is a mayor in Jackson, Mississippi, who is black. And this mayor, and you can look him up on Google, just look up mayor of Jackson, Mississippi, and he is calling for a complete five-state black America, where only blacks live. And I can look his name up very quickly because I've gone to the website. But he was voted in 99% because Jackson, Mississippi is 99% black. But yeah. He's called for South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, and Louisiana and Mississippi to become the new black America. Great. Where only black people are allowed. And if you go to Southern California, it's called Azatlan, and the Mexicans that have flooded into Texas and flooded into New Mexico and flooded into Arizona and Southern California want to create a Mexican state called Azatlan, and that's happening there. And if you go into places like Detroit, Michigan now, they are already calling for Sharia law, which again is antithetical to any kind of parliamentary constitutional republic, certainly of anything that's operating in the UK or in all of Europe, because it's a complete political system. So this thing is not going to stop with the Europeans or Americans or Canadians or Australians continuing to impregnate themselves with people who think this way. Teddy Roosevelt said this, and I think it's 100 years ago. He was our president back in 1902-10, and he said, and I'm quoting, "The one absolutely certain way of bringing this nation to ruin or preventing all possibility of its continuing to be a nation at all would be to permit it to become a tangle of squabbling nationalities and languages, unquote. That's a powerful statement, because if you impregnate a Western country, again, with 140 different worldviews, you start impregnating it with all of these different languages, and then you impregnate it with all these different religions, you are going to end up with sociological chaos.
But then again, that could be used against us as well, Frosty, because I heard Pat Buchanan describe culturalism as a sewer, and he thought that everybody should speak English. Well, I think it would be a disaster if in a quicker form of integration.
Yes, all I agree with you. I mean, I'm all in favor of, at the moment, given our crisis, I'm all in favor of institutional breakdown and the reign of multiculturalism, because the opposite to that is integrationism and assimilationism, and that has genetic consequences we cannot survive.
Well, that's correct, but again, what you don't want to do, and what I've called here in America, is to absolutely halt immigration, because you don't want to continue to impregnate not only a civilization with too many people, but you also don't want to impregnate the nation with disparate cultures, disparate and poverty-stricken peoples. From different ethnic groups that simply are unable. An example of that right now is Ferguson, Missouri, is a perfect example of the black-white relations in America that have never, ever come to any kind of compatibility in the last 400 years.
Americans don't vote for this. It's not their fault. They don't want this. Their wishes are ignored and overturned by, see, the Ninth Circuit Court in California and so on.
That's correct. And so what we're headed for is a tremendously unfortunate violent confrontation, and you're going to see more of it, because again, the world view of the African American has nothing to do with the European American. I mean, it's a totally different tribe. It operates.
I was born in Newark. You don't have to tell me.
Okay, so you understand that. I actually, as a Michigan State University student, was right in the middle of the 1968 Detroit riots. And to give you an example of all the burning and killing going on, I worked in Detroit, Michigan in the summers. From my summer job from teaching was a long-haul trucker. So
I saw the 67 ones in Newark, yeah.
Yeah, and Detroit, Michigan, it was the fourth largest city in America with 1.85 million people. And today, in 2014, because of the race riots, because of the schools, because of the killings of whites, because of the carjackings and killings of whites, the whites fled Detroit. Detroit is now reduced to 648,000 people. And in fact, half of that is now Muslim immigrants. And so vast tracts of Detroit are literally just look like a bombed out war zone.
I've seen places like that in New Jersey too. It looked like a Paterson, New Jersey looked like it.
That's exactly right.
Bombed.
And this is what happens when the African American numbers grow greater than the European numbers. You have, unfortunately, this systemic endemic poverty. And again, this is caused by, illiteracy that literally is intractable. And some people will sit there and say, well, you just can't say that. Well, it's just a fact. It is a manifested fact. The dropout flunkout rates for Detroit, Michigan right now, high school, 76% dropout flunkout rates. And for schools like Denver, Colorado, between 50 and 67% dropout flunkout rates. Chicago, the dropout flunkout rates are again 50 to 60 to even 70%. And so what you're finding happening here in the United States, and my bet is in most of Canada right now, and certainly the European continent and in Australia, is that these immigrants simply cannot measure up to the academic rigors of these Western countries. And therefore, their frustrations grow. They become welfare wards of the state. And this is a statistical fact that just came through this last week. 72% of African American children are brought up by a single mother. and she is, of course, on welfare.
That's a disaster. That's one theory of Freud's that I found to be true, kids without a father, they lack social conscience. They only have their mother's unconditional love, and they become sociopaths.
And so we have these massive gangs in this country. We have $25 million a day are shoplifted in mercantile goods out of American stores. $25 million a day, 7 days a week. That's the average.
Where do whites go? Did the Northwest, the Northeast?
They're migrating away.
Can they go to Siberia?
No, they're going to Oregon. They're going to Washington. They're going to Montana, Wyoming, North Dakota, South Dakota. They're flooding into northern Minnesota, northern Michigan. That's what's happening across the country right now.
There is separation, de facto.
It's called self-segregation. And in fact, you can see all of the places like Ferguson is 70% black. By the time this whole case of the killing of Michael Brown and the riots, a house in Ferguson, you can buy a house in Detroit, Michigan for $100 right now. And in Ferguson, Missouri, it's going to be probably the same, because the whites that are left are so terrified that they will leave Ferguson, and then Ferguson will be left to be nothing but a welfare. It's called the EBT crown, electronic benefits transfer. We have 48 million people, mostly minorities, on food stamps right now in this country. 48 million. In fact, it's 48.3 million. And so you're finding a breakdown of the African American family, the Hispanic family.
So we're not going to give up Europe, and whites are fleeing to the Northwest and the Northeast in America. What other places have you seen, Frosty, that might be havens for whether it's pioneer Europe's or ethnostates? You say that we need fresh water, and Lake Baikal is one of the biggest sources in the world. I wonder if that might be a place.
If from my own travels, I mean, if you were going to escape, the best place would be New Zealand at this point, but they don't let anybody in unless they've got a humongous amount of money, and they have to be self-sufficient. So we may see here, and we're seeing right now in Canada, is the Canadians have fled British Columbia, and they're now moving into Saskatchewan and into Manitoba for places to reestablish the English language and the Europeans. So you're going to see more of that as this the resources grow dim. You're going to see more of that here in America as the violence toward European Americans grows greater. And I can tell you right now, ironic as it is, Mexicans dislike African Americans, Black Americans, so much so that they actually were been killing them down there in Southern California, in the Los Angeles area, and whole blocks of blacks have fled for their lives. So the whole multicultural myth doesn't actually work. We're all facing this great human challenge. And so many are just fleeing it.
Frosty, if you're going to succeed at some point in raising awareness, you and the others who are engaged in this particular action, and people take note of it, let's say it's got so obvious they can't politically afford not to take note of it, when the public knows something and the politicians deny it, that situation can only really obtain until the first politician admits that there's something going on. So, you know, let's assume that that happens and that the political world does change, and there's some degree of acceptance of the crisis. How do you see, given the huge scale of problems which are involved with this? You know, you're talking about the oil crisis, for example. How do you see change and health actually being restored? Equilibrium. How can it be done at all?
Well, and that's what I have been working on, because I'm a firm believer. And let me give you the examples where it continued. With Mark Twain's the silent assertion lie, the slavery question was not was passed off in 1776. It was passed off when the Constitution of the U.S. or 1787 when it passed. And that was the deal of slavery. And even Thomas Jefferson said, we've got a wolf by the ears, we can't let him go, and we can't keep him. He's too dangerous to keep. And yet, the only way to create the Constitution back in 1776 and 1787 and pass it was to allow the Southern whites to maintain slavery. But as this silent desertion grew, it erupted into the Civil War. And so, as a student of history, I can tell you this. When you put millions into a financial slavery, if you will, minimum wage jobs, McDonald's, and so forth, or you keep them poor in their own countries, at some point they explode outward. And so my goal is to have a world conference of environmentalists and population experts created by the presidents of Canada and of the UK. And Eric Rimmer is in the UK. He's a friend of mine. He's a part of populationmatters.org.
Yeah.
And Brian McGavin, he's a part of the UK. I keep in touch with him weekly. He's working on an educational realm and advertising to get the issue out in front of all of the British.
You mentioned the Population Matters. That used to be the Optimum Population Trust.
That's correct.
Which was rather notorious in nationalist circles because it made all of these very warm-hearted sounds, you know, and it spoke the truth in lots of areas, but it never mentioned the elephant in the room, which was non-white immigration, never mentioned it. So, you know, we as nationalists tend to look at that kind of organization and think, well, you know, they're getting a good living, but they're not actually doing their job. They don't want to do their job. Has that changed at all, do you know, through Mr. Rimmer?
I think Eric Rimmer, and I've met him personally, here's the key. Everybody's got a different viewpoint. They come from a different grid. And a different grid means a different interpretation. You know, and of course, as a 21st century a Galileo on a bicycle myself, I get all sorts of criticism, but as a spiritual humanist, my final goal is that all human beings succeed, and they succeed in their own countries, they succeed in their own cultures, they certainly succeed in their own language and their own ethos. And in order to do that, the final equation is that the human race and all of these 180 countries and all these different cultures have to come to the educational standard that we need to have birth control universally and move all humans from all countries and all cultures to the carrying capacity of their country, of their landmass, their water, their resources, and so forth. And so at least I stay... I am not a biased person, I'm not a prejudiced person, I'm not a racist person, because as a world traveler, I respect that every race, creed, and color is paddling his or her boat as best they can.
Yeah.
And so that to me is the most intelligent thing to do, is that world leaders come together, speak, and then address, and then come up with a plan for universal birth control and acknowledge that the human race cannot continue on its current course. And that's my main thrust.
Some of those nations aren't going to be persuaded about birth control, though.
Well, then that's...
It's going to be a matter of force.
That's correct. And then when those... And it's in my book, America on the Brink, the next added 100 million Americans. And here is the case. If they're not able to step out of their ancient religions and cultures and deal with reality, they simply are going to be unable to exhaust all of their excess citizenry into first world countries, because first world countries need to hold the line and on immigration and stop it, and then they will have to deal with their overpopulation issues by themselves.
I think even that is optimistic. I mean, just dealing with the first world countries for a moment, we've got birth rates which are frighteningly low. I think in the UK it's about 1.5. I think in Italy it's something like 1.2 or 1.1. It's not much better than that in Spain.
Right.
So, you know, you're talking about holding the line. You have to realize that we are a rapidly declining demographic. Now, if you have a body of foreign peoples in your midst, there is within that body already a substantial force for increase. It's structural. You've got bride importation or spousal importation, you've got family reunion, you've got differential birth rates, you've got race mixing, which takes away ancient family lines from the native people. They go into the multicultural element. They don't belong to the natives. So that colonizing part of society has got inbuilt growth factors already. So if you were to hold the line, to keep that in balance with the declining native population, you've got to make deep cuts year on year already just to achieve that, unless we start increasing our numbers. So that's the initial starting point. You can't have any new immigration at all under those circumstances.
We need dead.
And you're talking about mass repatriation on a systematic basis, on a continuing basis.
Has to be.
Well, and let me appreciate that we either deal with educating ourselves and talking about the situation now and push it to the forefront of the leaders and get the academics to talk about it. And again, I'm an outlier. If you read Malcolm Gladwell's book, The Outliers, he also wrote the book called Tipping Point. Tipping Point is where you start to, you educate the mass of people. You educate them to the point where they then have a consciousness shift. They understand the gravity of the problem as I understand it, as you understand it right now, because we're educated, because we experienced it, we understand it mathematically. Then you create a critical mass shift. And the critical mass shift is where a society starts to move toward action to save itself and to change toward a successful future. And so my goal is to create the consciousness shift, then create the critical mass shift, which then creates the tipping point toward a successful and viable civilization. Now, either the UK and Europe does that collectively, or they simply will perish, and all of the immigrants will perish with them when it starts getting down to water and energy scarcity and exhaustion, which will happen in this century. There's no question left that gasoline and energy, the Hubbert curve is absolutely playing out right now across even the great oil fields of Saudi Arabia and the Middle East. And so we're going to be faced with the equation whether we like it or not, and we will be faced with it no matter how many immigrants we bring in or don't bring in at some point. Again, as Kendall says in his quote, Mother Nature is going to reduce our numbers rather brutally. I say, let's take action intelligently and proactively before that point, so that everyone that's listening to this discussion today then talks to and becomes members of such things as numbersusa.org, or creates a numbersusa.org in their own country, at, like Population Matters, or like Australians for Population Stabilization, or like the Canadians for Immigration Watch and so forth, or we simply become victims of a self-inflicted destiny. I say
I can agree, and I look forward to discussing more in subsequent conversations how we might achieve that tipping point of awareness, and also what we might do to organize ourselves in our defense.
Yeah, and we need to do that with those who are leaders, those that understand, those with money that can promote our understandings and our enlightenment. Because I'll tell you right now, this conversation that we're carrying on across the Atlantic Ocean is an extremely enlightened conversation. And there are millions who don't have a voice like this, because most people, most Europeans, most Americans, most Canadians, most people are very average in their thinking, and they go day to day about their business as they see their own civilizations deteriorate and degrade, and they don't know what to do. But if they have a voice in you, both of you, GW and Daniel, and then this man named Frosty Wooldridge, well, there's Tim Murray, there's Madeline Weld, there's certainly Joanne Weidman, there are Jenny Goldie, there are more voices out there. If we bring those voices into this, then it collectively raises the consciousness level of millions. And I can tell you this, my dad once said, and my dad was a really sharp cookie, he said, always, Frosty, speak up and speak your mind, because there are 10,000 people behind you who are afraid to speak their mind, and so they remain silent. But when you speak your mind, they will then raise their voices too. And so by having a discussion like this, we are empowering Europeans and Americans and Canadians, whomever listen to this, and say, my God, I've been thinking that too. I understand that too. Yeah. Let's take action. And that's the key here. I'm hoping that we take action and we form organizations that will take action to collectively empower the common man, who's going to become, in the end, the victim of this self-inflicted destiny of overpopulation created by mass immigration coming out of the third world.
I think that's a great start.
That's absolutely right. Thank you very much indeed for talking to us. So that's about it. And I'll leave it to Daniel to get in touch with you again and arrange another chat. And maybe in a couple of weeks or so, and we can carry on from there. Thank you very much indeed. It's been really, really interesting.
Okay. Thank you very much. Yeah. A pleasure, gentlemen. And may we go forward with intelligence and with action, and certainly with spirit of this great adventure called life and living on the planet. Amen to all of that.
Great, Frosty. It's been fantastic. Thank you very much.
Thank you.